ask me, what is the definition of hospitality? And I always say, hospitality is the front line of cultural diplomacy for a nation. How hospitable you are can position you on the world stage.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. This episode, we turn our attention to the hospitality industry. What does the future hold for travel and tourism? As listeners to this podcast have heard time and again, we live in an age of disruption. From healthcare to telecom to asset management, there's barely an industry spared from the onslaught of some new tech-driven business proposition that's poised to unwind the balance sheets of big brand players. The old time-worn solutions to old time-worn problems are falling away. To this end, we ask, what lays in wait for the hospitality sector? I sat recently with the Asia-Pacific head of one of the world's largest hotel chains, and when I asked him what kept him up at night, he barely missed a beat. Airbnb, he said. Barely a decade old, this rooms-for-rent business is today valued at more than $300 billion. It boasts 150 million users and operates in close to 200 countries. Today, Airbnb has more rooms on offer than the top three global hotel chains combined. What started out as a quirky lodging alternative for the casual tourist is rapidly becoming a high-end choice for the business traveler. For the world's biggest hotel groups, that's cause for concern. It's also cause for change. Rethinking the future of travel and its implications for the hospitality sector is the subject of this episode. My guest, Gaurav Sinha, founder of Insignia Worldwide and chairman and CEO of Quilon Hospitality. Originally from New Delhi, Sinha moved to Dubai in his early 20s to build a life for himself outside of India. He got his start in public relations but found himself drawn to the world of hospitality. He joined Hilton Hotels in the mid-1990s and rose through the ranks to become director of marketing for the Middle East and Asia. That experience forever shaped his views on what hospitality had become and what it might otherwise be. Gaurav laid a bet on his vision and started his own brand strategy firm, where for the past 14 years, he's consulted to some of the world's biggest hotel brands and wildest market destinations. Befitting the topic of our discussion, I sat with Gaurav on the beautifully manicured grounds of the Maya Ubud Resort in Bali. On a grassy knoll, we watched the late afternoon sun paint the gardens with a soft orange glow and listened to the rise and fall of the sound of cicadas. It was the kind of transition that framed the divide between staying in a resort on the one hand and experiencing a destination on the other. I started off by asking him about Insignia. What led him to set up his own shop and how his kind of brand enrichment differs from that of other creative agencies?
None of this has been a strategy. You know, when I was at Hilton, I discovered that I couldn't find another agency who understood the business of travel. There are certain complexities when you're marketing hotels or airlines or destinations. With you need to understand key feeder market dynamics, seasonality, segmentation, distribution, revenue optimization, not the usual terms that a typical ad agency speaks of. And I'm a storyteller who fell in love with hospitality. So that's really, I just put two things together. I found that there was nobody serving the need. And I decided to set up a company that will only make people fall in love with places, not products. Okay. So we're anthropologists, authors, and activists. What that means is we study the consumption of experiences. We author brands and ideologies that allow people to connect to those aspirations. And in some cases, when the brands are already cooked and they're ready, then there's a certain sacredness to that. Then we become activists to make sure that hotels make the right amount of money. Now with us, the way we operate is you can either, and I was using the analogy earlier, if you can come for a walk on the beach, we can go snorkeling or scuba diving. That sort of sums up how you can engage with us. We can do project-based work or we could be strategically embedded in your business. So we work with about, I think just shy of 200 hotels across 20 countries. You know, we've launched just maybe 30, 40 different hotels in different parts of the world. And we get involved in it's a very unique positive dysfunctionality that we have as a company, because we employ we actually ban the word agency from our lexicon. We are a brand enrichment company, and as a strategic consultancy, I employ from digital strategists to art directors to interior designers and architects. So, you know, you can involve us, and we engage with clients in very different ways.
But it sounds to me like it all begins with that upfront strategy, whether a hotel or a destination exists or whether it is yet to exist, but somebody wants to conceptualize, design, and deploy it. You get involved at different levels in different ways.
That's correct. You know, Steve, with us, we've managed to codify some of our thinking as we've grown over the last 14 years. And I believe the one thing that makes destination marketing very different from traditional marketing is that I believe when you're marketing a place, there are no USPs. So if, you know, we've sort of flipped it on its head, everybody says as an efficient marketeer, you know, you're looking for competitive pricing, product differentiation, accessibility, etc. And what we tend to do is we have a different lens when it comes to marketing destinations. So I believe destination marketing is superlative. It's never comparative. It stays true to who it is. So, you know, you can only have one Hawaii, you can't have two Hawaiis, you can't have two Dubais, you only have one. So the objective is to try and drill down to the enduring essence of a place and then activate what it stands for.
Well, how do you get to the bottom of the enduring essence of Kazakhstan or Nigeria, two locations where you're currently operating? Those are in the minds and the eyes of most average travelers outward and outbound destinations beyond anything people would think about. How in the world do you make those, create a concept around those two places as unique in a way that would be attractive to your average traveler?
You could add outrageous to it too, I think the frontier markets, how we fell into Kazakhstan was an interesting story. You know, we were invited to come and help brand a small independent hotel.
Invited by whom?
By the entrepreneur who was building this hotel, and we met a lovely lady and a gentleman who's the ex-mayor of Almaty, and they were building a hotel and they wanted help to create a truly luxury brand proposition, and our business is purely referral. You know, we don't really pitch for business, so we were referred by an ecosystem of existing clients, and I got on a plane and I went to Kazakhstan for the first time.
So they had this notion of a tourism destination or a business hotel for those that are coming to do oil and gas deals.
It was a mix of both, and I don't know if anyone's ever been familiar with Almaty. It's got some of the best ski slopes in the world.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's 1/10 the price of some of the best ski slopes you might want to go in Europe. So
there's your value proposition,
yes,
right there.
And you know, it's fascinating. I went to Kazakhstan, maybe about 6 years ago, and they were looking at building a hotel which was a boutique hotel, design-led, both for tourism, leisure tourism, and the corporate traveler. Obviously, the business has to have some sort of a foundation of logic, so corporate is a significant part of their strategy, but you do have other hotels. You have the Ritz there, and it's not quite yurts and quite what Borat has mentioned, you know.
Right.
So I think it's a very interesting place. For me, it was like going to the frontiers.
Yeah.
And so it was scary to begin with, like in the sense, because all your sort of, you know, paradigms are shaped by mass media. I think, but, you know, as I said to you earlier when we were talking, as you know, it's I think strangers tend to have a natural propensity to want to be friends. Mm-hmm. When you travel to new places, you feel welcomed. And if you look at the history and you track down the Silk Route from China to Mongolia, to Kazakhstan, all the way to Turkey, you'll find that they have similar values across all of this, traditions, values, the culinary aspects. Obviously, drinking horse milk is not necessarily fun, you know. So, I think it was.
But 40 years of communism will put a stamp on that. Will stamp that out, won't it?
I think there is an element of being subdued and not having voices heard, but quite honestly, I think there is a youth culture there. There's a huge youth base, and these young people travel. And I think they come back. They go to a great restaurant in Amsterdam, and they say, listen, why don't we have it in Almaty? Mm. And then they build one.
So it does require, I think, a little bit of revisioning, and clearly a strong public relations campaign, and maybe even a little public-private partnership with government, who has to be participating to some degree in order to make sure that all of the peripheral aspects of visiting Kazakhstan are helpful and conducive to driving the ultimate success of that hotel.
not just Kazakhstan, I think any destination that wants to excel and make a mark for itself on the global stage, you know, there are a couple of things that need to work in absolute synchronicity. Process, policy, investment, infrastructure, and brands, all and the players, they all need to converge in absolute synchronicity. And I think, you know, a lot of it is...
In order to have that ideal experience as a traveler.
Exactly. Yeah. In order to create the most welcoming. So you want to build a beautiful hotel, you need the roads to get there.
Sure.
And you need the ability to get a visa quickly. Mm. And you want the assurance that you'll have a great brand there that potentially creates a level of trust in your experience.
So that's the end game. But we also, you know, you and I have both experienced the Bali airport and walking in and that experience. Tell us a little bit about what that's like and how in some ways Bali is one of the great travel tourism destinations in the world, but it's not necessarily synchronous, is it?
No, it isn't. And I think, you know, its dysfunctionality is also its charm. You know, I think one of the things about living in Asia, I would imagine you've been here longer than I have. So, you know, there's a genuine sense of hospitality and grace that does exist here. I think what happens is when you don a uniform, you tend to switch your brain off a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think that's the sentiment that I've picked up on.
That's a universal truth.
You might just be true. That might be actually be one of the key insights I'm taking away today. You know, but I think, you know, what happens is we can't, there has to be a certain level of empowerment. You know, I was saying to you about the airport, you have, you know, the immigration officers who are gormless and don't smile. They've outsourced their sort of sense of hospitality to a bowl of mints that sit on the side, and if you pick one up and, you know, you're meant to feel welcomed. And then you have the breakdown of the traffic, the radio, you know, the traffic doesn't work.
Well, even before leaving the airport, though, I don't know if you've experienced this, but you're overwhelmed once you pass through customs, and you typically inordinately long lines, you're hit with this full in the face, the smell of urine from the horrible bathrooms that are sitting there in the baggage claim area. And I guess they rushed this whole, you know, this whole airport in time for APEC and the gathering of APEC. So they cut a few corners and they'll probably get it right over time. But it is not what you would expect to see when you land in Bali. You know, it just doesn't meet you or greet you the way that it does everywhere else when you travel beyond the airport. Of course, you're just about to talk about the roads and the traffic and the congestion and the chaos. But maybe, again, there's charm embedded in there at some degree. And it's the very contrast itself by arriving in a place like this, Maya Ubud, and the beautiful resorts and all of the nature, that you feel the power of it because you've been through a state of chaos in order to arrive.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think given the fact that such a significant amount of Bali's GDP is driven by tourism, I think the government here has an obligation to get a few fundamental things right. Mm. One is, you know, the airport, which is, in my opinion, your first point of contact with the culture of Bali. I think efficiencies can improve at all levels, and that usually starts with good training. You know, I think as long as the people are trained right, you can navigate a slightly scruffy airport facade, or, you know, the physicality of it, you can navigate through if people are trained to be empowered to make people feel welcome. I think there's a lot Bali needs to do right, but I think it's, you know, when you talk about, I'm going to take a step back, tell you about what I think defines enduring essence. Mm-hmm. So when people say to us, you know, what is the enduring essence of a place? I tend to say that the enduring essence of a place is, first of all, what nature gave it. Then what, over years, human civilization has brought to it as far as culture goes. Mm. And then you layer it with other aspects of infrastructure, innovation, investment. That's how you define the enduring essence. If you were to peel the onion on Bali, you will find that with the enduring essence of Bali is rooted, first of all, in this amazing environment that we're in. Mm. It is a beautiful part of the world.
So that's something that you can't create. You either have the foundation or the makings of a great destination, yeah, or you don't.
Yeah, and I think that's why you have to be true to who you are. Mm. So, you know, when it comes to Bali is this, you know, beautiful natural paradise with, you know, the volcanoes and this amazing, the river valleys and the rice paddies and the rice terraces and the beautiful beaches and the surf. So, you know, that's taken hundreds and hundreds of years to happen. And then you've had, again, you know, close to a millennia of people codifying their own unique version of Hinduism here. So if you just look at the potency of the culture and nature, then you can forgive the slightly shoddy airport. So I think this is part of the maturity of how you layer these things. And then obviously the private sector has created their own refuge of calmness away from the chaos. So like, look where we are sat today. We are at the Maya. It's a beautiful hotel, and there is no way both of you and I could comprehend if we were to try and explain to the listeners that literally 5 minutes away from here is an absolute traffic jam right now, which has 16 lanes in a one lane road, you know. So I think that's how you offset it. I think this is one of the reasons why when we work with Dubai Tourism or with Kazakhstan, the one thing we will never try and do is try and reinvent it.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So for us, the underpinning truth about Dubai is that it needs to be proudly Arabian.
Right.
I think it starts from there. It's what nature gave it. Nature gave it the desert, the sunshine, and a certain location on the world map.
Did they get that, or did they have to evolve into understanding it? Because for a while there was tension between who are we, and should we be the greatest modern city in the world with all the great buildings and technologies and infrastructure, or should we embed ourselves and be proudly promote ourselves as Arabian? Did it evolve, or did it happen from the outset?
And there's a very interesting story to all of this, in my opinion. I think it's always evolutionary. I think there is a certain framework of policy and vision, which I think Dubai and the UAE in general has been very lucky with, because they've been benevolent and brave. And usually, in governance, it's either one or the other. One is given up usually. So I think UAE, as in general, has both been benevolent and brave. Now, it's interesting, with Dubai, the way I see it, it was in the 50s. If you ask yourself, why does Dubai need to be the number one at anything? And from what I take away from it, it was in the 50s. Dubai is the original Dubai Emirati. They are pearl divers. They're sea-dwelling Bedouins. They would use the boats to go up and down trading, etc. And they're not inland Bedouins. They're coastal. Mm. And pearl diving was really their sort of main trade. That's how they
didn't know that.
Yeah, and they were pearl divers much before oil was discovered. Mm. When they were British protectorates and whatever else. And what happened is their pearl diving tradition was severely disrupted in the 50s because the Japanese created cultured pearls and completely wiped out their economy. In a way, because imagine that's really what happened. They created synthetic pearls.
So over within what, 5-10 years, gone?
Maybe lesser. And I think the ruler at the time said, never again will I let, such level of disruption come to my people. And it was in the 70s they built the world's biggest port, Jebel Ali. It wasn't, and then they happened to, strike luck with oil. But let's not forget, Dubai ran out of oil 20 years ago. Mm. And I think the vision with the Dubai, the ruling family and the governance is about never again. They're always one step ahead. They're very humble people also. And I think if you look at it, I always tell stories, of Sheikh Mohammed, who's the current ruler of Dubai, how cool he has been. He would take his director generals, 18 of them, on a short body 747, and they'd walk the streets of Singapore, and he'll be pointing at the size of gutters to say, learn, because this is how good infrastructure is created.
Well, I was just going to say that. I mean, Singapore in many ways is the Asian equivalent of Dubai, albeit with its own set of different foundation and that essence that you refer to. It's grown up and has basically clearly defined itself as that cusp or that hub for Southeast Asia commerce.
Mm, and I think if you look at Singapore, if the Singapore story is the fact that it's the land of second sons.
Right.
In Chinese culture, it was the first sons who inherit everything, and it was the second sons who arrived in Singapore to create something. So obviously, there's that innate sense of, achievement, this drive, there's fire in the belly. And I think that resonates. It's similar to Dubai. These are two small, nation states, and they've done extremely well for themselves. They've been outliers at so many levels. And again, it's a question of the right blend. I'll come back. It's process, policy, infrastructure, investment, and brands. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to codify that. The same thing, like when we were in Kazakhstan, we didn't want Kazakhstan to suddenly become a Dubai or a Abu Dhabi or a Singapore. Mm-hmm. So first you drill down to the culture, and you drill down and understand what is it that makes Kazakhi people different from the Uzbekis to whoever else. And you have to spend time mining for that. That's part of what we do.
This is Inside Asia. My guest is Gaurav Sinha, founder and CEO of Insignia Worldwide and the world's first brand enrichment company for the hotel sector. I'm Steve Stein. More in a minute.
Inside Asia is produced in partnership with 1880. a members club in Robertson Quay, in the heart of downtown Singapore. Born out of the idea that conversations can and will make the world a better place, 1880 offers a space in which diverse minds gather and great ideas bloom. For more information or to inquire about membership, visit www.1880.com.sg.
My guest is Gaurav Sinha, founder and CEO of Insignia Worldwide, the world's first brand enrichment company focused on the world of hospitality. We're talking about the future of tourism and what innovation in the hospitality sector might look like. Let's get back to our conversation.
For me, it comes down to anything about a place is about its people. You know, you can't talk to the trees. Well, I'm sure some people here in Bali have done that too. Right. But I think if you want to engage and connect to a place, you need to connect to its people. Yeah. And to codify that, you need to first of all make sure that they have sustainable lives. Not just lifestyles, rather, let's rephrase that. Now, if you go to Lombok and the poor person there who's working in the fisheries and is a fisherman working in a small village, if he's going to struggle feed his kids to begin with, he has no time to make you feel welcome. Mm. He's going to first try and figure out how he's going to eke a living for himself. Mm. So I think governance is about first taking care of its own people. Mm. You know, if you look at, I think these are the sort of things that I feel need to be addressed, you know, and I'm going to lead to the point which says, you know, if you ask me, you know, what is the definition of hospitality? And I say hospitality is the front line of cultural diplomacy for a nation. How hospitable you are can position you on the world stage. Now, how do you create a hospitable environment? You need to first take care of your people. Mm. If they're starving or they have to go into the bushes to, you know, every morning to do their morning business, and I don't necessarily think they're going to be very keen admiring how you're staying in your $600 room, you know, with all the luxuries that they possibly would never have in their lifetime.
And would you argue that that's been a consistent truth? If you look across the world at successful hospitality environments, it's because governments or private sector has cared for their people appropriately, which has allowed for the emergence of successful hospitality businesses or industries?
I think tourism generally has created tremendous positive impact across the globe. You know, it's a $6.6 trillion global economy. I think tourism and hospitality have the potential, if applied intelligently with patience and big visions, they can empower communities in a significant way. What we have to balance is human greed, and for which, unfortunately, there is no substitute. You know, I think so. We were talking about, you know, hospitality being the front line of cultural diplomacy, and I've always said, if that be the case, then why is the front line of luxury hospitality managed by economic refugees? You know, I'm a conscientious traveler. I come and check into a hotel and pay $600 a night on this beautiful island, and I know fully well that the person who I'm interacting with in their lifetime will never be able to check in as a paying guest.
Right. So what do you do with that?
I think you've got to address that in many different layered ways. And, you know, and I don't necessarily have all the answers. I have a view on what we can do.
Well, let's talk about that. In fact, the idea of your philosophy of travel, philosophy of being a traveler, and also different models that are emerging, because hospitality, like all these other sectors, are under pressure. They're being disrupted. Hospitality, no less. Airbnb is creeping in on the hotel business and resort business. We can see that. The shared economy is having an impact. But I want to take this down in two levels. One is, how do you think it can emerge? How can the hospitality sector basically be more engaged and therefore create a better business model? And at the end of the day, you know, where are we headed with this and what are the prospects for it?
You know, we need maybe an hour on just this question, you know, but I'll try and give you my tuppence's worth. I think when it comes to hospitality, we have an obligation. So there's a lot of good that's being created, number one. I think communities, whether you're working in Africa and we're working in, you know, different parts of the world, from Equatorial Guinea to Namibia, and if we talk about Bali and we talk about Kazakhstan or Dubai for that matter, I think hospitality and hoteliers, currently the challenge is that we've got industrial luxury in hospitality. You've got a lot of private equity firms, they're public listed, hotels are owned by PE firms and they're listed on the stock exchange, etc. The only way, unfortunately, they can show, you know, projected earnings and you know high and protect their share prices is not by doubling their room rates. They've got to show more inventory in the pipeline, which is one of the reasons why you see so much expansion, consolidation. And I think we live in historic times. There's a huge amount of disruption. You're right. When you talk about Airbnb, and I think hotels are waking up to the fact that this renaissance is not going to be about the way you look. It's about what you stand for. I think what people want is people want human interaction. In order for human interaction to be genuinely gracious and to be genuinely generous, you need to make sure that that other person is genuinely happy. Now, there is a lot of good that hospitality also does. When you open a new hotel in a community, you create small ecosystems from laundry companies to food suppliers and, you know, people buying food from the local farms. So there is good, but it's not, is it sustainable? Is it fair? Yeah. I think today's traveler, the more conscientious traveler, is going to dig deeper. It will not rely on that little tent card by the bed which says, you know, here are the four things we do. They will want to know more. And I think that accountability will change the way corporate governance currently addresses some of these challenges that they, in my opinion, don't really address very well.
So there's the issue of employee engagement, and potentially you're talking about employee ownership of these resort or hospitality ventures. And there's also the issue of the traveler and the traveler's hopes and expectations that go beyond industrial travel. So let's talk about the employees a little bit. What's the vision that you have for how hospitality can emerge with more buy-in from the employees, from the workers themselves?
Okay, so you know, I have a chronic sense of discontentment with pretty much everything I do.
I don't get that sense. Is it true?
It is. Trust me. All right. You know, I'm always sort of, you know, questioning, you know, A, whether we are doing, you know, good. Are we driving the business positively? And we try and live by some of, you know, I'm not very sermonic in my proposition because I like to implement what I do. You know, so from when we talk about doing good, you know, our company, we have eventually ended up running a charity with 500 kids we take care of purely because we wanted to create positive impact. It's not difficult. It's a question of whether you have the conviction to follow these things through. I think hotels eventually will evolve into co-tels. They'll run as cooperatives. I think the next generation hotel will not have employees. They'll only have shareholders.
As a retention strategy, or because, as you said before, the culture of the hotel is born up in the people who meet, greet, and take care of you while you're there?
I think it's going to be an element of both. And I think the only way I can prove this is when I build my own hotel.
Okay. So this is conceptual right now. In your mind, there's not an organization out there that's actually come up with this, but you have a vision for what it could look like.
None whatsoever. There's nobody out there doing it with the right level of consistency and impact. I think I've talked about CSR being lipstick on potatoes, and that's typically how it's been running, not just in hospitality. We could talk about CSR across different segments, and it's not very different. But I think to codify and create an alternative currency of goodwill that exceeds the HR department giving you a reward program to either be incentivized to get an extra $100 or two extra days off or a better shift to work on. I think these things, let's face it, it's happening to a certain level, but is it happening with the ability to create shareholders? No, nobody's doing it, which is why I think in order for me to be able to explain this, maybe I need to build my first hotel.
And it's a great way in. I mean, live and learn, find out what works, rebuild, try it again. And, you know, there's some other organizations, some other sectors which have experimented with this because it's coming up. The idea of the, you know, old style shareholder is falling away. Lots of new startup organizations are coming in, like Juno in New York, the ride sharing service that said, we're going to be a better service than Uber by, one, giving higher percentages to our drivers, and two, creating share ownership structures for them so they can feel like they've got some participation in the business. But we know that Juno was just sold, and those agreements that they had with their employees and their drivers may be at risk now. So good intentions are good intentions, but what happens when capitalist forces come into play and you're no longer able to abide by them?
This is the rub, you know. How do you manage human greed? And I think this is where you have to be true to your essence. And I think if you ask me, you know, let's try and answer what is the definition of a truly, and I use this word, you know, with a degree of trepidation, luxurious experience 30 years from now. You know, your daughter, your granddaughter, your, you know, whoever it is in your ecosystem, 30 years from now, let's say, how will a 35-year-old, you know, define an aspirational experience. And I think it'll not be our version of, you know, bling or whatever else that people have consumed, whether it's Gen X's, the baby boomers. And I think as this evolves, what I personally see will happen is two things. I think the corporation will evolve. If you think about it, why was an LLC created? A limited liability. A limited liability was an instrument of privilege given by a sovereign government to an individual in their quest to do good for society. Mm-hmm. Today, the corporation has no good for society as part of their mandate. Right. Yeah. There's a fracture. So the only promise a corporation has today is with its shareholders. Mm-hmm. So now how do you fix that? It's quite easy. Make the society your shareholder. And I think if you start joining these couple of pieces together, and I'm not an economist or somebody who can frame all of this, and I'm sure there are far more clever people who understand how to put these things together. So I'm going to strive to do that. And I think the thinking is very simple. There's a bunch of people in a village next door. You're going to build a hotel and become a millionaire off the back of it, maybe, not because it's not easy making money in hotels. But you're going to leave these people behind and just give them the least amount that you can, you know, in order for them to succeed and survive. So I feel empower them first. Build the people to be significantly impactful. And I think if you did that as part of your journey, you'll find that every human being who wants to travel to a new place will gravitate to that particular destination and place.
So you place a high hope on the idea of people who wish to go and to a destination and give something back and be part of a giving culture, that they're prepared to go post-capitalist on this because you believe in the innate goodness of man and the innate goodness of people, and that it's just a cycle. We're cycling through a period of luxury travel, luxury vacationing, and now you think we're at a point where people really truly want to basically participate at a different level.
You know, so what is the definition of travel? Travel is the ultimate expression of self-advancement. You travel to enrich your life. Now, whether you were Christopher Columbus and you traveled, you know, west, you know, and whether you're traveling today, you know, you travel to improve your life. You know, save a marriage, recover from a heart attack, you know, close a business deal, simply reconnect to your family. So, if travel enriches your life, I personally believe then travel can also enrich the lives of others.
Yeah, well said.
We've just got to make that extra leap on this. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there is this conscientious consumption. I think what's going to happen is we've got to redefine what success means. Success, and we were talking about this earlier, I said success, currently society rewards, qualifies success as your ability to consume. And I think success in the future will be your ability to create, whether it's creating positive impact or innovating the way we consume. I think this is a fundamental shift that is happening, and I think travel and hospitality have a very unique privilege and responsibility to be able to mobilize this. So, and I think that can happen. I think we are sitting in a, and it's happening with other brands. It's happening in fashion. You know, you look at, you know, buy a pair of this, you know, give a pair away or whatever else. And I think, why don't hotels do that? Why don't I check into a hotel and somebody says, you know what, for every night you stay here, we're giving two homeless people a free night stay.
Well, and I think there's been write-ups on this and research on millennials as generational, this new generation coming in. They now are more interested in experience and purchasing experiences as opposed to purchasing products. And a lot of their decisions they're making in life, whether it be career or friends or destinations, are based on that. And there is a willingness and an openness to this idea. But do you believe it could happen for those who currently are wealthy or have enough income to be able to do what they want to do? Or do we simply have to wait this out 30, 40 years till the next generation comes through and adapts and embraces what you're talking about?
No, I think we will see rapid change happen. I think generally, you know, the human tendency is to do good, as much as, you know, make money and whatever else. I think if people are given the ability to be able to grease the cogs, they will. I think what we need to do is create those instruments that allow people to share goodwill in a more efficient manner. Currently, I think, you know, if you wanted to transfer money right now to your daughter in the U.S., it'll most probably take you 3 minutes on your phone to, you know, go through the app and transfer, let's say, $200 to her.
Yeah, I tell her it takes a month.
So now imagine trying to do the same thing with your goodwill. Who do you transfer it to?
Yeah, well, this is the problem. And I think cynicism has been born from this, because we talked about this corporate social responsibility. You know, this, you refer to it as lipstick on a potato. It didn't really fulfill. It didn't deliver on the promise. And there's a level of cynicism which has crept in. We need to kind of get back and redefine that and find out whether or not there is an opportunity for corporations to take ownership of that and do something good with the money they're receiving as their way of giving back and as a way of providing an outlet for people who want to give back.
I think it will begin when consumers start expressing that they value it.
Right.
So, you know, so because the private sector, capitalism has its own way of recalibrating to consumption needs. So if you today decided that it is your choice to not buy a pair of shoes, which you know cost, you know, $2, but they're being sold for $250 in a sweatshop in Bangladesh. But if you decided that you will, for the rest of your life, never wear those sort of shoes, and you're happy to wear some espadrilles for $20, and if everybody around you follow the same way, then I guarantee that that person selling that $220 shoe, either he'll go bankrupt or he'll have to recalibrate to your values. So what we have to do is we have to change and drive the values home. If everybody decided in the whole world that they will not buy a television unless $10 from that TV was being given to some village somewhere to create electricity, Amazon would do it. And now they have, by the way.
Yeah.
If you go, they've started offering, but they charge the customer.
Right.
I believe the merchant should do it,
right,
not the customer.
Yeah, I mean, voting with your wallet, and there's been debate and discussion about this for years, and then you arrive at a point where, you know, you hope that one action will then create a reaction, then will create a mass action, and before you know it, you have a movement. We're talking about with solar energy right now in the United States, in almost, you know, defiance of our current president and his view on and his love for coal and oil and gas, people across many parts of the country are saying, I am going to invest in renewable, and solar is on the front edge of this. So they may tip, you know, get that economies of scale and tip the scales on this so that you do have a situation where we can fulfill on this promise. But it's you're talking about, you know, a percentage of people that have the luxury of making that decision versus the person who's hand to mouth and is shopping at Walmart and, you know, Joe Sixpack. What do you do with that?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, that's such a fundamentally large question. And I think I can bring it back to my industry.
Mm.
Take care of the people around you.
Right.
I think it begins from them. I think this sense of community that we want to create, you know, whether hospitality does that quite well, to make it sustainable. I think if you can make sure that we can reduce the level of poverty, you can empower people to be able to realize their dreams, you know, give them jobs. There's dignity in all of it. Like somebody said to me, now there's the other side of the coin. You know, we can talk about people being on minimum wage. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a very simple philosophy on this. As long as you're honest and you're working hard, the outcome of that is dignity. Now, whether you're cleaning a toilet in Namibia or whether you're changing sheets as a Romanian immigrant in London in a hotel, I think hard work and honesty gives you dignity. I think as long as we collectively as a generation go about creating dignity for others, I think you'll find that there is that movement, the mass movement, can happen pretty damn dramatically.
I can't think of a better way to end our conversation on that note. I mean, that's almost like a call to action. It's an aspirational, and I think it's extraordinary, idea. And as and when you build that hotel, I want to make sure that I get an opportunity to check in and enjoy it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. And when the hotel does get built, I intend to make sure that you're one of the first few people who come and join me.
It'd be my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Gaurav Sinha, chairman and CEO of Quillon Hospitality and founder of Insignia Worldwide, the world's first brand enrichment company for the hospitality sector. To learn more about Gaurav and his organization, to link to some fun facts on Airbnb's meteoric rise to success, or to explore the beauty of the Maya Ubud Resort in Bali, visit our website. There you can browse any of the other 24 interviews, stream, download, and listen. Visit us at www.insideasiapodcast.com. As our regular listeners know, we like to conclude each of our episodes with an attempt to tie up our conversations with a few takeaway thoughts. We call it a bunkus, which in my part of the world is a kind of brown paper wrapped on-the-go meal. Each week, I sit down long distance with our show's producer, Steve Hayward. We listen to the taped conversations, and we also bandy about a few ideas. That's what we did this week, and we had some questions. Does Sinha, for instance, offer us a vision of the future of the hospitality sector in which we can believe, a vision in which we can invest? Well, I'm not sure. He speaks of industrialized luxury in the world of hospitality where success is determined by room rates and occupancy levels. That might be fine for the investors that back the big hotel groups, but is it sustainable, particularly at a time when disruptors lurk in every wing? The day is coming, he assures us, when hoteliers will wake up to a new brand of service, driven less by the bottom line and more by a commitment to assist the traveler in the experience of the place to which he or she has traveled. Outlier organizations, separate and distinct from the hotel chains and online booking agencies, has something new on offer. This new lot, so he believes, will craft then cater to an evolved class of travelers less enamored by hotel glitz and more inclined toward destinations that abide to the cultural and aesthetic nuances of any given destination. In other words, might the trappings of four walls and a bed one day give way to a more holistic quest for destination experience, where human interaction, not things, distinguish one hotel from the next? The more conscientious traveler will dig deep, says Sinha. Hotels are waking up to the fact that it's not how you look, but what you stand for that sets one apart from the other. In an age still driven by price points and last-minute deals, it's hard to imagine. Do people actually care more about each other than about the bottom line? Can consumers drive the market in a more ethical, human direction? Part of me would like to think so, but then I ponder Henry Warner, who in 1927 wrote to his brother, pontificating on the future of the movie industry. Silent movies at that time had achieved global acclaim. How could they get any better? How much further could the film industry actually rise? Who wants to hear an actor talk anyway? Asked Henry. The two would go on to found Warner Brothers Films, and the rest is history. The impossible is a funny thing that, given that sometimes it isn't, impossible that is. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.
Inside Asia is produced in partnership with 1880, a members club in Robertson Quay, in the heart of downtown Singapore. Born out of the idea that conversations can and will make the world a better place, 1880 offers a space in which diverse minds gather and great ideas bloom. For more information or to inquire about membership, visit www.1880.com.sg.